¿Qué papel ha jugado?
Nicola, what could we say about the role that the people of Yemen have played, not just ideologically and politically, but in shaking the consciousness of the entire Arab and Muslim world? What specific role have they had in striking against the targets of the Zionist entity and those who collaborate with them, including the United States itself?
Bueno, el rol que ha jugado Eduardo es impresionante.
Well, Eduardo, the role that Yemen has played is truly impressive. It's remarkable because that country, which seemed unknown to the West and to the popular masses in the West, suddenly emerges on the global geopolitical and geostrategic map as a nation of tremendous significance. The United States goes in with two aircraft carriers, the largest, most complex, and modern ones, along with eight destroyers and frigates, to threaten and attack Yemen in order to assist in protecting the criminal, child-killing entity that is Israel. Notice that, shortly after, one of the aircraft carriers suffered a severe blow, while the other took a moderate hit. Some ships were hit by missiles and had to quickly leave the Arabian Sea and exit the Red Sea, because they realized that Yemen's weapons can reach them. Weapons that, by the way, they built with their own hands. On the other hand, Yemen created a very important maritime blockade, a blockade in the Arabian Sea, in the Gulf of Aden, and in the Red Sea, against the criminal child-killing Zionist entity. This blockade was quite effective, but unfortunately, through land routes, the treacherous feudal monarchies and the Arab collaborators, the reactionary Arabs, created a land corridor to supply the Zionist child-killing entity with the necessary products. Indeed, Yemen was and still is by far the strongest, most determined and best ally, as well as the most effective ally that the Palestinian people have had.
Let's take a break and continue right away, Nicola. Thank you very much. We're back here with Nicola Hadwa for a powerful interview about this incredible country and its wonderful people called Yemen. Nicola, you were discussing how it has humiliated the collective West, as we might say, and they have been forced to take measures to transport their products through alternative routes, which also means higher costs. That's already a victory, by the way. Please continue with what you were saying.
Por favor, continúa en lo que estabas relatando.
Bueno, sí. Yemen logró imponer una ecuación nueva.
Well, yes. Yemen managed to establish a new equation and show that the Israeli child-killing entity was not an invincible army. It was, in fact, a considerably weaker army and country. Unfortunately, those who do the dirty work for this criminal entity are the Arab reactionaries. When Syria, supported by Iraqi militias, was about to enter and open the front to the Golan Heights, the feudal monarchies, along with the Turkish traitors, took it upon themselves to overthrow the Syrian government to prevent them from opening the front to the Golan Heights against Israel. When Hezbollah was delivering a massive beating to the Zionists in southern Lebanon, remember that on the first day of the attack, Eduardo, the first day the criminal Zionist entity attempted to enter Lebanon, it lost 30% of its attacking force and failed to advance even 10 meters. I mean, we need to know that the defeat inflicted by Hezbollah was at such a level. Well, then the Arab reactionaries, with a pro-colonial government, which we could say is recolonized and closely allied with imperialism, threatened Hezbollah with a civil war if they did not agree to a ceasefire with the criminal regime of Israel. In the case of the Palestinians, when the front in Jordan was about to open, the Palestinian National Authority, along with the Zionist agents, mainly Mahmoud Abbas, took it upon themselves to suppress the Palestinian people. The resistance battalions located in Tulkarem, Nablus, and Jenin, arresting many and handing them over to the Israeli child-killing regime. In other words, the Arabs and the Arab reactionaries, they have been the ones doing the dirty work for the Israeli criminal entity. In the case of Yemen, the empire tasked Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates with trying to suffocate Yemen in an operation that involved the British, French, and American troops, along with the entire Saudi military and the forces of the worst traitors in the Arab world, the United Arab Emirates, who managed to occupy the province of Ma'arib in Yemen. The province of Ma'arib is home to all of Yemen's oil and gas reserves, aiming to cripple its economy. Nevertheless, Yemen stood firm, defeating the occupying forces, overcoming Saudi Arabia and pushing out many of the imperial British and French soldiers. The Yemeni people are impoverished, I must reiterate, but they are fierce fighters who do not know the meaning of defeat or surrender.
Ni conocen la palabra rendición, Eduardo.
Así es. Nicola, algunos analistas dicen...
Indeed, Nicola, some analysts suggest that there is an exodus of settlers fleeing from the occupied Palestine, citing one of the reasons as the ongoing and persistent missiles and drones coming from Yemen that keep them in a state of anxiety and alertness. In fact, in an analysis I read, it mentioned that the shrapnel that sometimes falls even on the beach prevents them from enjoying their summer, from being by the sea, basking in the sun, and they have to leave because the shrapnel falls around them, which puts them in a state of nervousness and fear. What do you think about the significance of these bombings that may seem small and insignificant, yet are constant?
Throughout the ongoing war, aside from the bravery displayed by the Palestinian resistance, which has notably dealt significant blows to the Israeli occupying army in Gaza, consider that they have been fighting for 2 years without being able to defeat the Palestinian resistance. Zionist military analysts claim that the strength of the resistance is only growing. It's worth mentioning that the actions of the Zionist regime mirror those of the Nazis, who, when their soldiers faced defeat, turned to attack the civilian population. What actions is the Zionist regime taking? This regime cannot exist in peace, nor can it thrive in war. Yemen, with its meticulously calculated, well-defined, and carefully planned attacks, has contributed significantly alongside the Palestinian resistance. This is crucial, and I will elaborate a bit more. The fact is that 1.5 million people have emigrated from the occupied territories, and the majority, over 70%, are young individuals who refuse to join the army. They have come to realize that this war is not going to end soon. They understand that they are as vulnerable as the innocent Palestinian civilians. For instance, you can observe that currently 2 or 3 fighters arrive daily from Tel Aviv to Buenos Aires, bringing along the Zionist child killers. This war has uprooted, as I mentioned, 1.5 million occupiers, but what are the implications of this? Not only the fear and the evacuation of occupants from Palestine, which has led the United States and European powers to speak up and reveal their concerns, but we could also say that there is a rapid recognition of the Palestinian state. However, this is aimed at saving the Zionist regime from a definitive and total collapse. Why? 66,000 businesses have gone bankrupt. There are no workers, and the evangelical zealots who are used as cannon fodder to fight against their own Christian brothers have not been enough to get the productive machine running. The banking system is paralyzed, commerce is at a standstill. They cannot meet their international commitments, and they are unable to fix the economy. The most optimistic say that this criminal entity, Israel, could recover in 10 years. The number of Jews coming to Israel have dropped to zero. Consequently, the Israeli regime is becoming completely unviable. On one hand, the Israeli occupiers have realized that their regime was serving transnational corporations and American imperialism rather than their own people, who spoke of a Jewish land meant only for the Jews. Well, they came to understand that they were sending their young men to die. They let them perish and even killed themselves. I mean, whenever they had the chance to eliminate an Israeli captive at the hands of the Hamas fighters, they did so. When an Israeli soldier is captured, the Air Force goes in and bombs the area to kill that soldier, and also the members of the Palestinian resistance. Thus, they have recognized that the regime does not care about the Jewish people or the so-called Jewish land at all. What truly matters to them is the interests of transnational corporations and supporting American imperialism.
Nicola, tú pusiste un punto muy importante al inicio.
You made a very important point at the beginning just now. You mentioned that the movement seen in various European countries to recognize and establish a Palestinian state is either a salvation or an attempt to preserve the occupying Zionist entity. Please elaborate a bit more on that, as it is quite significant.
Mira que es muy importante.
Claro. Es lo más importante. En este momento, Estados Unidos...
Of course, that's the most important thing. Right now, the United States and NATO, having seen all their plans fail, are moving on to another plan, hoping the Arabs will do the dirty work for the Israeli criminal entity. There is talk of quickly recognizing the Palestinian state. The Palestinian National Authority is not just some treacherous collaborators. In fact, the Palestinian Authority is like a second Israel. Those collaborators would be responsible for managing Gaza and the West Bank. Here, the criminal Israel has become divided. The majority does not want the Palestinian Authority to govern either Gaza or the West Bank, and the parliament has agreed to annex all of the West Bank. Therefore, this plan could fail just like the French plans of Charles de Gaulle, which were undermined by the most reactionary elements in Algeria, namely the OAS. So, in this case, once this figurative state is created and accepted, which would have no army, whose economy is intertwined with Israel, and which lacks clear borders, it is ultimately a foolish idea that only the United States and Israel could conceive. Once the Palestinian Authority wishes to enter Gaza, then the Arab League would be responsible for forming an army, supported by the Zionist army, equipped to enter Gaza and defeat the resistance that the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, with their child-killing Zionist army, have been unable to overcome, as they have all been defeated. I mention this because there are American, French, and British border soldiers, official troops who are there and have died, and among them, more than 50 Americans have lost their lives.
Nada más que norteamericanos muerto más de 50.
Así es, Nicola. Bueno, el tiempo aquí es brutal.
That's right, Nicola. I really appreciate your remarks, and it's clear how important the struggle of the Yemeni people is, along with their courageous attitude and a solidarity towards the Palestinian people, serving as an example for all countries that claim to be sovereign. Thank you so much, Nicola, for being with us here on Black and White.
Thanks. It's a pleasure and honor for me to be part of such a great program that you host, Eduardo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Welcome to all our listeners. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. And here are some interesting facts about Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning, the recitation of the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we'll listen to the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start this hour's lineup with the Ocean of Dua, which gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books, such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamelu Ziyarat. Our varied radio productions feature will follow next. And our final program this hour is again our radio productions feature. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning.
The Ocean of Dua.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. And in this version of the program, we are trying to cover some of the names of the Almighty Allah that are recommended to be recited to invoke Him for obtaining benefits. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum wa al'an alahum ajma'in.
Listeners, Al-Muqaddim is another name of the Almighty Allah to be recited while we are trying to invoke Him. Al-Muqaddim means the vanguard, some kind of a forerunner. In contrast to this name is the name Al-Mu'akhir. Al-Muqaddim was related to the beginning, and Al-Mu'akhir is related to the last and ending. Al-Mu'akhir means the eternal last. The true servant believes that the Almighty Allah is the first and the last one to refer to. Another name of the Almighty Allah is Al-Muta'ali. Al-Muta'ali means the Most High. The Almighty Allah is in charge and in power, and He is capable of doing anything to us since we are His true servants. A mu'min, a believer, never stops his or her trying, alongside having dua and supplication and invoking Allah, relying on Allah, doesn't mean that we should stop whatever we are doing. In fact, on the contrary, it means that since we know that we rely on someone who is all-powerful and the Most High, He will help us in our affairs. But prior to that, we should do our best and do our duty and ask the Almighty Allah to help us complete and fulfill it.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is al-alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as al-jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean, and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water. The ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab anjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab anjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala va pas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will, God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah. God let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through. Knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
Among the names of the Almighty Allah to be recited while we are trying to invoke Him and ask Him for something, in order to gain more benefits, is this name, Ya Malik al-Mulk. So Malik al-Mulk is the absolute sovereign. And we call him by this name since he is the only one who owns everything. And it is somehow like asking the Almighty Allah to give us whatever he knows that it's best. Since he is the Malik al-Mulk, he is the absolute sovereign, all-knowing and all-seeing. So the best kind of dua is the one that he thinks that's best for us and that suits us the best. Another name of the Almighty Allah which is closely related to this is Al-Mughni. This name means the independent. By knowing and believing in this fact, that the Almighty Allah is the only one who is self-sufficient, the true meaning of self-sufficient is Him. He is the one who owns everything. He is the true and absolute sovereign. Then who would we refer to if we need anything? Another name is also Al-Mu'ti, which means the bestower of gifts. The Almighty Allah is self-sufficient, but also is the one whose favors are spread throughout the universe. He is the absolute Mu'ti. He is the total bestower of gifts. Dear brothers and sisters, among the names of the Almighty Allah to be recited while we're trying to invoke Him and ask Him for something is the name Al-Mani', which literally means the prohibitor. Repeating and reciting this name at a great deal is recommended. Al-Mannan, the benefactor. Since it means the benefactor, the reciting this name a great deal regularly will help us obtain divine favors and rewards. And it is exactly what we previously mentioned. The Almighty Allah is the absolute cause. He is the creator. He is the all-knowing and all-seeing. And all these epithets and nouns and names come in row just to prove one thing, that He is the absolute cause and He is the one that can be worshipped. So you can see the sense of monotheism in all these names of the Almighty Allah that are mentioned and will be mentioned. Of course, all the things we are mentioning in this program, dear listeners, have some different conditions to be met if we want to achieve the results. But whatever happens, reciting these names of the Almighty Allah will bring more the attraction of the Almighty Allah, and we can gain more benefits, especially while we are invoking Him and reciting dua. Walhamdulillahi ala afwihi ba'da qudrati. Walhamdulillahi ala tuli anatihi fi ghadabi. وهو قادر على ما يريد الحمد لله خالق الخلق باسط الرزق فالق الأصباح ذي
بالجلال والإكرام والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
And the last name, dear listeners, that will be mentioned in this program to be recited in the beginning of our du'as or while we're invoking him and calling on to him is the name Al-Muntaqim. Al-Muntaqim literally means the avenger, the one who avenges and gets revenge for someone or something else. If somebody's rights have been taken away from him or her, the true Muntaqim is the Almighty Allah, the All-Powerful, the Most High, and the Avenger, since He is the one who is punishing those people in Hereafter and Resurrection Day. Anyway, the name Muntaqim, the Avenger, can be recited many times regularly, and the enemies will never be able to harm us again. Dear listeners, we ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Thank you for staying with us. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the hall of shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice. Our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. Thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking?
waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
along the winding and beautiful road, we're heading towards the city of Tuisokan, that's enclosed by green and picturesque valleys. A city that was built atop the ruins of an old town destroyed during the Mongol invasion of Eurasia. Tuisokan is in the province of Hamedan in western Iran, about 5 or 6 hours drive from Tehran. The weather at our destination is mild and pleasant for this time of year, but since the city is surrounded by the Zagros Mountains, it can become very cold at night and at winter times. Because of its vast walnut orchards, Tuisokan is known as the hub of Persian walnut. But that aside, all the things I'm going to show you will point to the rich historical background and culture of this city.
Mansions that has stood the passage of time since the Qajar period is this two-story building, the Masudi House, named after the actual residence, and it's now a museum. Come on, let's go inside.
The most eye-catching thing in the entire house is the chamber on the first floor where guests were entertained. The entire ceiling and walls of this room are covered with stucco, mirrorwork, paintings and motifs depicting the kings of old Persia, scenes from the Shahnameh or Book of Kings. But this is not the only attraction of the house. If you take a look around, you can easily breathe in the beauty that lies here.
You can imagine that house was considered to be a grand house about 130 years ago when it was commissioned. The people who lived here were the descendants of a Qajar prince called Abbas Mirza.
The Masudi House isn't the only historical monument in Tuisokan. There are still plenty more left, and we're going to visit as many as we can.
If you search for the city of Tuisokan on the internet, one of the first images you'll come across is a photograph of this mausoleum. This is where Habakkuk, one of the prophets in the Hebrew Bible, actually the 8th of the 12 minor prophets, was put to rest.
It's not only because of Habakkuk that this shrine is valuable. The architecture that has allowed this 12-meter-high mausoleum to survive some 900 years is also astonishing. From afar, it appears to have an octagonal form, with the cone-shaped roof comprising 16 columns, arranged in an interesting way. It is this architectural form that has allowed it to stand firm against storms and earthquakes. Tuzerkan's attractions aren't limited to man-made and historical sites. Apparently, there's more. Some of the locals gave us directions to a location that's home to one of the oldest living trees in Iran. The 2,000-year-old Barbar sycamore tree. I'd hazard a guess that it's about 35 meters high. And it has a really thick trunk. Tuzerkan is filled with old and resilient trees, most of which are walnut trees. Tuzerkan is famous for its top quality walnut trees, so we've come to this walnut orchard to find out what all the fuss is about. Walnuts actually grow inside a green husk inside which you have a hard brown walnut shell. The meat's inside the shell, of course. The first step in harvesting walnuts is to actually get them off the trees, and the easiest way to do that is by shaking the branches, and in Tuzerkan, it's done the traditional way. The locals usually wait for the walnuts to ripen and for the husks to change color before they do this, because then they are able to shake the walnuts loose without harming the tree. People in different cities have different homemade dishes depending on the climate and the vegetation that grows there. Since Tuzerkan is literally filled with walnut trees, we're going to go and find someone who'd be able to prepare a local dish for us with walnut as the main ingredient. Safavid dynasty, Shah Abbas the Great commissioned the construction of some 999 caravanserais throughout Persia, each of which was approximately 30 to 50 kilometers away from the other. Okay, so we've arrived at the Shah Abbasi caravanserai. In the old days, travelers and merchants would stop at these caravanserais to replenish their supplies and refresh before heading out again, maybe even sell a few bits and bobs. It was built in the 11th century in the Safavid architectural style. Once in a while, travelers would have had to stay indoors for days at a time, protected within these high walls from thieves and bandits. The images that come to mind when you think about all the events that took place here during those times. All the different people, the colorful clothes, the stories these walls would tell. If they could speak. Artimani Mausoleum, which is where Mir Razioddin Artimani was put to rest. It's hard to believe that a mere 41 years ago, this site was in ruins when the Cultural Heritage Organization took up the task of rebuilding it. The mausoleum is symmetrical in shape and design, with three brick arches on each side. This is one of the four entrances, all of which have been decorated with these beautifully designed tiles.
The locals refer to him as Mir Razi. He was a very well-known poet and mystic back in the Safavid period. From what I've read, his sonnets and quatrains are very deep.
We've only covered half of what Tuysar Khan has to offer, be it the vast areas of land decorated with natural foliage or whispers of a long-gone civilization. This is Gulnar Farnoodi for Iran.
IRIB English Radio.
The picturesque town of Kasimov, deep out there in the endless plains of rural Russia. It was a grand town once, wealthy in imperial times. The Russian Tsar came to visit. Now it is as much known for tourism as anything else. With its rich history and idyllic location above the Oka River, there is also a stunning 600-year-old mosque. This land is where Europe and Asia meet. I'm here to speak to Austria's former foreign minister, Karin Kneisel. She has effectively been exiled from Europe because she promoted good relations with Russia. And she now calls this beautiful town of Kasimov her home.
Mrs. Kneisel, the Americans recently concluded a deal to operate the Zanzibar corridor through Azerbaijan. It's been given a very Trumpian name, the Trump route for international peace and prosperity. Particularly the Iranians seem a bit worried about this. Are they being paranoid, or are they right to be worried?
Now, what if I put myself in the place of the Iranian government, and also I would say average Iranian, I would also be worried. I would not be amused, to put it in a British way, because it means that this lease of Armenian territory by the U.S. Government, by a group of security companies, logistic companies, which are all somehow related to security agencies, they are just at the in the very close geographic proximity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I can fully understand their second thoughts.
We know this region is very important for Russia and Iran. It links the two countries. We also know that Russia is effectively at the moment fighting a war against NATO, and that some NATO countries are interested in the Caucasus as well to destabilize perhaps both countries, Russia and Iran. There have been some commentators in Russia who are really sounding the alarm over what is happening there. Do you think it is dangerous to have the Americans controlling this corridor for the Russians as well?
Well, I would say it could cause some hiccups for a number of countries, also for Turkey, because, of course, this corridor opens trade possibilities for Turkey. But on the other hand, they have American security agencies just in front of the door. It could also cause hiccups for China, because the People's Republic of China has been constructing its Go West corridor, the Belt and Road Initiative, for the last 12 years. So here, all of a sudden, they have now some sort of new trade scheme, which might conflict with their trade schemes. Plus, and here comes Russia into the game, Russia and Iran are building up the North-South trade corridor, which is an interesting combination of different forms of transport. It would involve river navigation on the Volga River. It would involve container on different highways that have been constructed, plus also maritime transport. So the North-South corridor, which is a very ambitious project, not yet really implemented. Here, I think that the Russians could be, well, again, let me say, not too much amused. This from a trade point of view, from a national security point of view, and the critical voices that you can read and hear here in Russia about this scheme and... You said you're sounding alarm. Yes, I also read these bloggers and listen to these commentators. I think what they would like to point out is the following. The Caucasus, the Southern Caucasus in particular, has always been a hot spot of rivalry, of all sort of ethno-tribal warfare, plus great power politics. The so-called Great Game, it did not concern only Central Asia. It was also all about this rivalry between the British Empire, the Russian Tsarist Empire, and the Indian Empire, which was more and more eaten up by the British, and of course the Persian Empire, which under the dynasty of the Qajar was totally unable, military unable to make sure that it would not lose territory, and it was Persian Empire under the Qajar dynasty that lost territory. It lost Armenia, it lost Azerbaijan to Russia, and later on Azerbaijan and Armenia were part of the Soviet republics, and it lost other parts of the Caucasus. So this region has seen some wandering frontiers, and it has always been some sort of hot spot. And you can easily instrumentalize a small group to make troubles. And plus, the Caucasus is a corridor, as this Trump corridor says. And when you take, for instance, the pipeline that BP built in the early 2000s, going from Baku in Azerbaijan via Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, to Ceyhan, in Turkey. This pipeline, let me recall for our audience, was only possible after a war in Chechnya. And maybe this pipeline project by BP, British Petroleum, Beyond Petroleum, whatever you would like to call them, they call themselves Beyond Petroleum, but sometimes they act as British Petroleum when they're in troubles. And this company maybe was also involved, I have no evidence for that, but maybe was involved in certain changes that we saw in Georgia in the early 2000s. The pipeline initially was conceived as crossing Chechnya, And that was a great momentum for the Chechens to fight for independence, because they thought, oh, we have a transit fee that will be our income. So it's all interconnected. And we know the troubles that the Chechen war made. And there were two big Chechen wars, one in the early 1990s and the second one in the early 2000s. So there are many, many elements that if you add all of them up together, you can see the powder keg.
So I read an article recently in an American foreign policy magazine saying that the Americans can try and sell this to the Russians, because it's important to get Russian support, or at least not too much opposition from them, to sweeten the deal for Russia so that Russia can benefit from it economically as well. Do you think any kind of deal in the Caucasus will be tied to, as you say, the Great Game, maybe even conversations in Alaska, at least the Trump administration trying to bring Russia closer to the United States? Do you think Azerbaijan can be a part of that?
Well, Azerbaijan is not an isolated element. Azerbaijan is connected, as we see, to whatever is happening in Turkey. And here the question is, who controls who, if I may say, or who monitors who? Is it Ankara, which does it with Baku, or maybe a Baku that somehow monitors Ankara? It depends on the situation. Plus, we have, of course, also the big actor China, for which the Caucasus and this entire region is the entry gate to their markets. And Turkey is an important market. I would say it's much more important than whatever remains of Europe, because demographically speaking and financially speaking, Europe is not such an interesting market in the long run. But Turkey is, and Russia is, and the Caucasus, we really have to understand it in its geographic importance. And the old German statesman Otto von Bismarck said once upon a time, without using the word geopolitics, but maybe he was one of the first geopolitical thinkers, he said, geography is the constant factor of history. Geographie ist die Konstante der Geschichte. And we see the return of geography on all levels. So such a corridor across Armenian territory to connect two pieces of land belonging to Azerbaijan, but at the same time very close to the border with the Islamic Republic of Iran, all that makes a lot of people think twice.
Do you think it could lead to war?
We are in a series of frozen conflicts there. None of those conflicts has been truly resolved. What was signed in Washington on the 8th of August was not yet a peace agreement. It was a memorandum. It was an exchange of documents. I don't want to underestimate the importance of that meeting, the signature by both presidents, Aliyev and Pashinyan, together with President Trump. But it's not yet a peace treaty. And whatever we have seen in the 90s, none of this conflict is really solved that you can speak of peace. We have many fragmented territories there. We have, by the way, the great Russian writer Lev Tolstoy and also Mikhail Lermontov, they were both shaped by their soldiers' life in that region. So you cannot imagine a masterpiece like War and Peace, the epic, the big epic of Russian literature, without the Caucasus.
And what do you think it says about Iranian-Russian relations? How would you assess that now? It's flashpoints like this, disagreements that do does throw up questions about how important these two nations are to each other. There are some who believe there is a global war going on between the East and the West, that Iran's survival and security is essential for Russia, and indeed vice versa. Would you go that far, or can there be disagreements between them?
Between Washington and Moscow?
Between Tehran and Moscow.
Ah, between Tehran and Moscow especially. Of course, there can be agreements and disagreements, and it's not a kind of smooth path that they will converge on everything and anything. And there is now a growing partnership. It has recently been boosted up by also some military exchanges, which did not exist beforehand. But Russia and Iran are neighboring countries which share the Caspian Sea, which is not a sea, it's a lake, because it's not connected to the open sea. And we have always had there all sorts of troubles in the Caspian Sea, whether it was fishing rights, whether it was drilling, oil and gas, pollution coming with that. So this lake, the Caspian Lake, is definitely one of the many points of, could be, of divergence, because there had been problems in the past, and they managed in 19th century to settle certain things. Also, let us recall that the times of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union existed until 1991, and the Islamic Republic of Iran got into existence in 1979. And on the one hand, you had the so-called atheist communist empire. On the other side, the one party that was considered as a not always accepted opposition was the Tudeh Communist Party in Iran. And there were also all kinds of accusations about interference. We have seen in history, we see in present day, also points of divergence. But of course, it's all a matter of how you handle that. And I always say, for me, Russia is a country of the East. It's not Europe. Some people might not like it, but why do I say, luckily, it's a country of the East, like Iran? The East knows the many shades of gray. While the more you go to the West, especially the Europe of these days, it's all about black and white. So you're either with us or against us. And having traveled to Iran on many occasions, living now in Russia, having somehow grown up in the Arab West Asian countries, I more and more know how to cherish this opaque grayish. As a person with, if you want, some Germanic background, of course, at certain instances in my life, it troubled me, because I said, it's so Byzantine, it's so opaque, it's not clear, I want to see more clearly. It's corrupt, you can also say, but it gives you the possibility to live next to each other, not necessarily with each other, but next to each other. And this is the mastery of the Easterners.
Let me turn to the horror that's happening in Gaza and wider Palestine. Sergei Lavrov recently said that by the time European leaders get around to recognizing Palestine, it will no longer exist. What do you think he meant by that, and do you agree?
Yes. We are in real time witnessing a genocide. While we talk to each other, most probably the 60,000 Israeli reservists are called up to make their final attack on Gaza City. What we see is a genocide in real time. And many countries have called a spade a spade. President Putin said already in autumn 23, what is happening in Gaza reminds him of the Leningrad blockade, of the starvation of a city during 1,000 days. This is what is going on. Many EU capitals remain silent, not all of them. Ireland, Spain, they opened their mouths. But when we take countries like Germany and Austria, they are just quiet.
What is happening in Germany? I know Austria a little less, but in Germany particularly, if you protest for Palestine, you're arrested now. It seems, particularly Germany, seems
also in Austria.
And Austria as well.
Yeah.
It seems disturbing the level of protection they are giving to, as you say, this genocide in Israel.
Yeah. And it's not only political circus, it's not only the media. It's nearly impossible to be slightly critical of Israel. It's in German we say the antisemitismus keule, it's the stick of antisemitism that